Well, turning to Acts chapter 24, those first 21 verses that we read, the title to this evening's sermon is this: Paul's Critics and Ours. Paul's Critics and Ours. We see how Paul has arrived here in Caesarea, or the Roman base in Judea, where the governor's place of residence was. Jerusalem, obviously the religious capital and the place where the governor often had to be in appearance and had an army stationed to keep the peace of the whole province. But Caesarea, where his own court was and where he had his place of office. And so it is to Caesarea that Paul has now been brought under that massive armed escort. The plot to kill him having been discovered, the efforts that those 40-plus men had gone to in order to set a trap for Paul, have him killed on the way to some fictitious hearing that the Sanhedrin, them also being complicit in this murder plot, but Paul's nephew somehow by the providence of God overhearing it. And so Lysias, the commander, has written to Felix, the governor, and Paul is now brought there to the governor himself, Lysias the commander having passed him over into his hands. We figure somewhat relieved to be discharged of having to work out what exactly it is that Paul is accused of. He found himself there, a military man, being called upon to make a judgment on matters of religion that he really didn't feel himself confident to do. So if you will, he's now palmed him off onto Felix, so Felix can sort him out, moved him up to the higher court. So it is a curious providence that has brought Paul now to Caesarea, but it is part of that plan that the Lord has revealed to Paul that he is on a journey ultimately to Rome, that he is going to stand before the people of Rome and testify. And we haven't reached Rome yet, and there's a fair way to go still before we get there, but we are moving firmly in that direction. Well, my first heading then, those introductory comments made, is this: a fairer hearing. And a question mark we can put after that: a fairer hearing. Is this a better court that Paul now finds himself before? Remember, he's appeared before the Sanhedrin, and they were a deeply prejudiced court, though their own law would have required them to listen carefully to Paul, to judge his orthodoxy against the scripture, and then to come to some verdict upon his behavior. But they were not going to give him a fair hearing. The high priest, deeply prejudiced against him, and Paul, the masterstroke there, had brought confusion into the whole place by pointing out that actually he believed in the resurrection of the dead, which immediately set the Pharisees against the Sadducees. And there was chaos. And these two groups did not acquit themselves well in the sight of Lysias the commander, who must have watched on, bemused and horrified at the way in which this religious body had now descended into chaos. And so he had to actually take Paul out of that situation for Paul's own safety. A religious court supposedly judging on religious matters, and yet it was almost developing there into a kangaroo court, and they're trying to lay hands on Paul to kill him. So he has now been brought before Felix, the governor. Is there going to be the likelihood of a better hearing for Paul here? Well, we've seen that Ananias, the high priest, armed with an orator called Tertullus, has appeared in Caesarea 5 days. They've not wasted much time, hot on the heels of Paul. Doubtless much vexed to hear that the Lysias had plucked him out of their jurisdiction and placed him more firmly in the jurisdiction and safety there of Felix. But their rage against Paul knew no bounds. 5 days, they were back for more and had travelled themselves there to make further accusation. Well, in a sense, is this a better court? We wonder, because Felix does not have a good reputation in history in terms of his character. He was known to be a rather cruel man, not a very just man at all, a man given to, well, he had the high priest in Jerusalem murdered before now, and had got his post there by some family preferment. Perhaps not a particularly suitable man for the post, but good connections had led to him getting this position. Not that he was doing particularly well in post, and of course during Paul's time here he gets replaced by Festus eventually. So a man who was open to corruption, a bribe here and there, would do very nicely in his books. So Paul has now appeared before him. Not exactly a huge advance, we might say, over and above the Sanhedrin and the high priest. But yet, this man was controlled by the overarching principles of Roman law and had to acquit himself well as a judge and demonstrate competence and impartiality, have to hear the case carefully, lest he himself be had up before the Roman authorities for negligence in terms of his governorship. The high priest, of course, was a law unto himself. And if the Sanhedrin had decided one way, then there was nobody else in religious terms who would argue against them. Whereas Felix, his position was a little less secure, and he had to do a better job than the high priest in terms of being a judge, even given all the things we have said about his character. So his post, his position, there are certain moderating circumstances around it that mean that he has to listen a little bit more carefully and judge a little bit less arbitrarily. The Jews are actually before him in somewhat of a position of weakness. Ananias and the elders there have employed Tertullus. We'll look at a little bit more at him in a minute. And give a rather grovelling address. All of these flowery terms with which Tertullus opens there, none of it is true. The Jews hated Felix. And so all of this stuff that they are saying about all this peace and prosperity that you have brought to our nation, these are really outright lies. And well, Felix probably knew that. And their description of him, most noble Felix, and all the thankfulness with which they receive from his governorship these blessings upon their province, this is all nonsense. They're having to say it because he has pegged back their power. They're feeling limited. They realize now that their best chance in Jerusalem to get Paul has slipped away from them, and that they're going to have to work harder and win over Felix in order to get their ends. But they know that Felix looks upon them very askance. He hasn't got a great deal of time for them, and they're having to use this grovelling address to him here to try to get round him. Well, Felix, we're glad to report there, doesn't necessarily cave in to their particular demands. He can see through them. And how important it is, actually, that we do have a fair hearing, that we have judges who will give to us a fair hearing, who are not swayed by the kind of approach here that the high priest putting the words into Tertullus's mouth to bring by way of his oratorical skills. How good it is that we should have judges who have a desire to maintain credibility, to be seen to be fair, whose judgments will be scrutinized by other judges, by higher courts, if that is the case, and who have shown that they have adhered to the law. And we can be, I think, by and large, glad in this country that we have judges who have to adhere to the law, that we haven't got many corrupt judges, people that have been bribed or anything like this. We disagree fundamentally with some of the judgments that they bring, though we can understand why they reach some of the decisions that they do. And we think of the Ashes case in Northern Ireland and this original judgment that is being appealed against at the moment. Well, we disagree with the judgment that was brought, though we can see the reasoning of the judge, even though we might say it was faulty reasoning. But we're glad that there are judges, that there are those who can oversee judges and appeal judges, who can overturn perhaps less well-reasoned judgments. There was the case, wasn't there, of the open-air preacher in the West Country, who, as it turned out, came before a judge who is on the sort of Sharia court circuit. And this man found fault with the preacher and levied some fine against him, but that was overturned. And the open-air preacher was not found guilty of the charge that was levelled against him. We know in our own history that the Magna Carta back in 1215, celebrating That's a last year in that regard there. Though itself a relatively imperfect document and still quite full of a partisan nature. But it did bring in, at least as far as the barons were concerned, vis-a-vis the crown, King John, the fair trial system and swift justice and circumscribing of the power of the crown and the kind of cases it could bring. Here it was against the barons, it wasn't against the common people. They had to wait a little while yet before such freedoms were given to them in law. But it was a hopeful beginning, and we can see today that we enjoy what we call that Judeo-Christian foundation to our justice system of a fair hearing, of being able to be heard before hopefully 12 unbiased people that constitute the jury, a fairer hearing. There are countries in this world where it's not so easy to get a fair hearing. Christians in Pakistan have great difficulty finding somebody to defend them because lawyers who have stood up for Christians have ended up being killed by mobs, by Muslim fanatics who are not happy that anybody should defend Christians who have been falsely accused. We grieve for Christians in that kind of case. And are glad that at least there is a fairer justice system in this country and that we are innocent till proven guilty. So we can say, on a happier note here for Paul, that he is before a court where there is at least a chance now of a fairer hearing than there ever would have been at the hands of the high priest and the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem. But I move on to my second heading, the power of oratory. The power of oratory. We notice here Tertullus being brought into play, the secret weapon, if you like, of the Sanhedrin to use in this courtroom proceeding. An orator. Likely as not here, some kind of rookie lawyer, maybe just cutting his teeth out in the provinces, hoping to make it big time one day in Rome. A fluent man. He would have been able to stand in a context like this and been fluent, and also a man capable of using flattery. We have said how hated actually Felix was by the Jews, and yet here he is flattering the man in an attempt to win him over and to bias the judgment against Paul. Power of oratory. That's why Ananias, the high priest, perhaps a little less certain about how to conduct himself there in this setting with Felix, and maybe indeed not wanting to go face to face with Felix, but have somebody else to represent him, given maybe some of the bad blood that existed between them. And the thing is this, we can understand why they employed the services of this man. For sure, he would have been paid handsomely to do this particular task. People are impressed by oratory. They are swayed by people. A bad case can suddenly become a good case in the hands of a skilled orator. The speaker's confidence, intelligence and wit, whatever else it might be, can sway public opinion. And here, of course, can perhaps move the mind and the heart of a judge. That's why there aren't there famous lawyers there, barristers in the Old Bailey who press juries and try to get their client there off some dreadful case when the evidence perhaps is as stark as daylight that they're guilty. But yet they'll use oratory and try to create some impressive surroundings that will sway the mind of the jury. And it is a sad fact that sometimes it does work like that. Sometimes people can have a very good case, but by bad presentation, bad preparation, it can be lost. The Jews here had a very bad case, but they thought if they had a good orator, a bad case could actually look a good case. But the opposite is also true, and a good case can sometimes suffer for being badly represented. So we see in the world at large, sometimes there are populist speakers who have the capacity to incite and to raise tensions and generate their sort of movements in one direction or the other. Demagogues and tyrants have used this to great effect. One doesn't always agree with much of the reaching into the Nazi history there to draw comparisons, but one can only too easily see how there the oratory and the skill there of the Nazi leaders, or some of them at least, Hitler included, could move people, could make a very bad case seem somehow right, and can change people's minds over and against their better instincts. Dictators, leaders, fascists, various people in the past who have used oratory in order to move public opinion. Well, we can say they're tongue-in-cheek, can't we? Presidents and such people as this, grand speeches that we're hearing at the moment in the presidential nominations and the jostling for position there. Well, we have to be careful, as we trust the American public are careful. What are we reacting to? Do we get swayed by oratory, that the person is amusing and clever, witty, learned, educated, whatever it might be, something that's conveyed in all of that that makes actually a bad case look good? How susceptible are we? Are we actually judging the case carefully, the evidence, if you like, even if the evidence that the person is trying to conceal with their oratory is to some extent being obscured from sight? But do we diligently search out actually what is the matter and get to the heart of it, cut through all the swathes of oratory and rhetoric and actually find out what's the nub of the issue? Is it a good case that is being advanced here, or is it actually a downright bad case and one that we should immediately reject? So we must always test our own hearts. What is it we are reacting to? What is it that's swaying us and moving us? And is it actually the fact of the matter or something else? So the power of oratory, a double-edged sword. But then thirdly, my next heading, the charge sheet. To tell us, after all of this flowery language and flattery, gets down to it. And as Luke records it here for us, he doesn't spare Paul at all, does he, in this? He there begs to have a few words heard by Felix, and then straight in we go. For we have found this man, verse 5, a plague, a creator of dissension among all the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. Well, he doesn't mince his words here, and he certainly doesn't avoid a charge of exaggeration against him, really. Throughout all the Jews, throughout the world? Well, that's a very strong, big claim this man is taking. But the oratory is sort of climbing up to this, and this great portrait that's being portrayed here or depicted here of Paul as this terrible figure, creating trouble every single place where he goes. That certainly is Tertullus's aim. And we have to say that as he speaks in those terms there, it has a very contemporary feel to it. Paul's critics sound very much like our critics or the church's critics today. Tertullus, well, he could be one of the new atheists, couldn't he, today? They're speaking their great words and all their erudition put to this. And some of those who managed to make it a little crisper and put it into their 144 Twitter characters on their blog sites, they're denouncing creationists or whatever else it might be. It is all very, very familiar. And the kinds of actions and tactics of a Tertullus are the kinds of actions and tactics of critics today. Paul, he's a plague, they say. He's a troubler. He's bringing nothing but grief. Well, that is asserted of preachers. Troublers. Why, there was some man who wrote something in the Times a couple of years ago, it is now, describing faith as a virus. So, dear friends, you're virus carriers. Do not think of Zika and all of these kinds of things here, or whatever else, avian flu that we may have about us. No, we are carrying the virus of religion, and we go around infecting people with this. Troublers, we are a plague. Creators of dissension. That's a contemporary thought. We divide communities with our hate speech, that we insist on Jesus Christ, the way to heaven, not Muhammad, not Buddha, not some other road or path. Why, we're told, this is hate speech. This is divisive. This is pushing communities apart. And President Obama in America advising us all, as Christians there, to smile happily over at Islam and acknowledge our Abrahamic roots. supposedly. So he would have us do. Well, we disagree with him on that, and we disagree with the charge that we are divisive when Christians have often been peacemakers in lands and in situations, maintaining their distinctive beliefs, but nevertheless able to show great love to their neighbours. But that's a contemporary kind of accusation that Tertullus uses. And then a ringleader of a sect that immediately paints it as being a narrow partisan group that's just taken up with some odd, eccentric distinctive there, definitely away from the mainstream. So Tertullus is trying to push it away from the foundations of the Jewish faith and paint it as being some oddball, eccentric thing. And, of course, that, again, has a very contemporary feel to it, that Christians, evangelicals get sort of pushed away and labelled pejoratively as fundamentalists or something like this. Brainwashing people, ringleaders of sects. Well, there'll be those, I'm sure, accuse me of brainwashing people, brainwashing our children here and those poor children that we're inviting to the holiday Bible club, indoctrinating, as we were thinking about this morning, and all the kinds of things that have spoken against Christians. The head teacher up in Lancashire that we keep mentioning that seems very topical given what we're looking at here. So those accusations, there is Paul, the sect of the Nazarenes, it's giving it there, this title which is dismissive and mocking. After all, what came out of Nazareth? And he goes on further that Paul tried to profane the temple. The man, this plague, this creative dissension, went into our most holy place and deliberately tried to render it impure. And there he was, and what an affront it was to all of the people there. So this idea again, that we actually spoil the Christian faith, that this Bible-believing stuff, it's most unchristian, if you like, that we are a divisive, troublemaking people, ringleaders of odd views, be it creationism or something like this. And then there is this idea that this violent taking of him by Lysias, the commander. We were trying to judge him according to our law. Well, that was downright lie, wasn't it? They were going to absolutely pull him apart. They were going to kill him there and then. He hadn't had a hearing whatsoever. It makes it sound as if there was a very learned council of them together discussing with him there his views and getting to the bottom of the matter. When this Lysias comes in there above his station and snatches him away from us by force. Well, we know that that is a total lie, and it's some cheek where they insist that if you examine him, you'll find this all out as actually being the fact there. They really are flying kites with this particular thing. But you can see here that almost the common efforts that are made today by opponents of the church to put the authorities on the back foot, to try to get Felix into a little bit of difficulty here. Had his commander been a little over the top? Had he been a little bit officious here? Had he taken him by force? And well, the Jews assert it most certainly did happen, just as Tertullus had said. And we know how opponents of the church try to use the authorities, try to get their demands through, whether it be to remove faith schools or whatever they think that they are achieving in this day and age, always trying to manipulate power in order to get outcomes that they want, going to law there against guest house owners that refuse gay couples' beds, whatever else that it might be, trying to exploit the law, use the law to gain their particular end. And here it is that they're trying to get Felix onto the back foot, to draw him into an area of uncertainty as to whether, in fact, due process had been followed and that maybe Lysias had been violent, snatching him away from them, that these Jews had a point here and had been aggrieved. Well, we can see this basically for what it is, a pack of lies. And here is a sad lesson that we have to learn, and sometimes to our cost, that people do lie. They might lie to our faces, that there is sometimes no compunction in people, that if it serves their interest, they will lie. And that comes hard to us as people, I trust, that have great love for the truth, love to tell the truth, love to have the truth told back in return. But people do lie. Lie to our faces sometimes, or lie about situations. Paint it in such a way that half of the truth is there, but half of it is obscured. And I fear to say that the media sometimes are very, very good at doing that and painting Christians in a negative light and painting everybody else in a marvellous light compared with. People lie. People can speak with confidence. See how the Jewish leaders perjure themselves, basically, by assenting to all Tertullus had said, maintaining that these things were so. They add their imprimatur to it. Absolutely shocking. And yet people are prepared to do that in order to rid themselves of a problem, secure some advantage. Though not everybody who's not a Christian is a liar, we're happy to report that, and many non-Christians deplore the sort of behaviour I'm describing here as much as we do. But nevertheless, there is that capacity that people have to lie to us, and we have to factor that into our thinking. Now my final heading, Paul's response. Paul's response. Well, he's heard all of this, and he would have known the score here and what Tertullus was about, knowing that he was a paid lackey and all of the intricacies of the political situation between Felix and the Jews at this time. And so Paul then answers. We notice a few things about his answer. First of all, he is also courteous to Felix and without flattering him, without asserting things that were not true about him. He recognises that he is the judge here in this situation, that he, Paul, is cheerfully going to answer for himself before him so that he, as judge, can ascertain these things. He recognises the man's position as given there by the Roman authorities, though he's not going to flatter him like Tertullus with things that simply are not true. So he's courteous, and he's also not afraid. He may have an orator like Tertullus up against him, but Paul declares there that he is cheerfully going to answer for himself, that he is not cowed by any of this. And you would have Felix know that he's not feeling guilty about things or a bit shifty about it, that there's nothing unsettling in what he's heard or somewhere in which he's admitting, well, maybe they've got a point here, or maybe there's something in what they say that I really need to hear. No, he is fully persuaded that it's absolute lies that are told against him. And he is not afraid of the high priest nor the elders that have come from the Sanhedrin along with Tertullus. And we notice that he responds having listened to what has been said. He has paid that courtesy to his opponents that he has actually listened to what they have said. For his response shows that he has listened very carefully to what Tertullus has said and reacting there to the main points of what he has said by way of accusation against him. He doesn't deal with all the flattery and flowery language. He doesn't say to Felix, look at all this, can you not hear this for what it is? Paul is pretty sure Felix can well hear what all of that is and has dismissed it completely from his assessment. So Paul responds to the facts of the matter. What is the substance of the accusation that Tertullus, on behalf of the high priest, is bringing against him? So he responds to that. He doesn't stray from that brief. He keeps to that point and then brings in other matters as are helpful to him. And we notice that he is bold in pushing back, that he doesn't allow them an inch in this, but challenges them basically to provide the evidence. Where is the evidence for these things that he is supposed to have done? He can do that very confidently because he knows that there is none. You'll notice he mentions there in verse 11 to Felix that Felix may ascertain, it's a matter of public knowledge, that he has been in and around Jerusalem for no more than 12 days. And that 12 days, well, however that period is counted, whether it is also including the 5 days since he has been arrested. But it's a very short time, hardly time enough to get an insurrection off the ground, hardly time enough to have incited a great movement in his favour and established himself as the ringleader of this particular sect. He's not been in the area long enough to really seriously achieve that. This wasn't the day of social media where you could get a mob there within half an hour, as it were, or demanding something. You had to do things much more slowly because you didn't have the communications of that day. Could he really have so quickly achieved all of this? And he puts that to Felix, that he can check it all out for himself as to the timing of this. And he denies flatly the claims there in verse 12 that he was there in the temple disputing or inciting the crowd. Indeed, neither in the temple or any other meeting place or in the city itself. They cannot prove the things of which they now accuse me. He puts that straight back to them, cuts straight through the oratory, places the onus straight back on those who had come bearing these accusations. And so we see him pushing back there, denying their claims, stating very categorically that they have no evidence. And we notice further in verses 18 and 19 that he points out to the governor, it wasn't even these people who saw me in the temple in the first place and objected. It was these Asian Jews, these Jews from Asia, found me not profaning the temple. Paul corrects to tell us on that, purified in the temple, neither with a mob nor with a tumult. Again, he flatly denies all of those things. And he points out politely that they were the ones who saw me, apparently. They were the ones who levied these accusations against me. They should have been here, not the high priest who wasn't even there, or Tertullus, who's being paid to come here. It should have been those Asian Jews, and mysteriously, they're not present. And so he introduces there this fact that actually his accusers aren't even present there to give eyewitness accounts. Lysias himself isn't there either to be able to answer for himself as to what the orator Tertullus had asserted of him. So he pushes back. But he also doesn't spare their blushes. He is not averse to causing them a little further embarrassment. There they are, really quite outrageous. Now, after all that dispute between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, they've seemingly patched up their differences. Their inveterate hatred of Paul has meant that they're now making a common cause again together. They're back on speaking terms, having been shouting and railing at each other in the earlier meeting there in the Sanhedrin in Acts chapter 23. But Paul is not going to gloss over that little local difficulty. And he begins again to open up the various areas that were the fissures between them. And as he did this, doubtless some of the Pharisees and Sadducees were shuffling a little uncomfortably at the reminder of their unseemly behaviour earlier, and of the fact that the Pharisees themselves were forced to agree that Paul was orthodox, that they expected the resurrection of the dead. And Paul, you see, opens up this subject all again in verse 14 and following, correcting this idea of it being a sect. He pushes that accusation away and actually declares himself to be orthodox. He worships the God of my fathers, believing all things which are written in the law and in the prophets. And so the Pharisees and this little ensemble of people that had come from Jerusalem, they would have been thinking, yes, he had said that, hadn't he? And we agreed with him in that. And there they are, as it were, making objection against Paul. Their objections are beginning to drain away from them. He's reminding them that actually they have points of agreement, not disagreement. And he goes on to open those fissures up a little further when he reminds his, basically his accusers here, he's speaking before Felix, but he's actually putting an appeal back over to his accusers that they are looking for the resurrection of the dead just as I am. And he speaks to them there as having always strived to have a conscience without offence toward God and men, which was a little reminder to Ananias, who had insisted on hearing that somebody strike Paul on the face. And so that might have just created there a little tremor in the conscience of Ananias. Paul is not sparing them their blushes, reopening up those fissures, probing their consciences. You see, in a sense, wanting to win them, wanting them to actually see that the teaching that Paul is bringing is consistent with all that the law and the prophets teaches, and that the resurrection of the dead is something that is firmly established in the Old Testament and has now been realized in Jesus Christ. So there is Paul dealing with his critics and indeed our critics. And as we see, the courteous way that he deals with them, the way in which he's unafraid, listens carefully to what they've said, and then is very firm in pushing back and going straight to the nub of the matter and bringing, as necessary at times, embarrassment into their camp because of the way that they have spoken. Many of those critics that are speaking out very vehemently against that head teacher in Lancashire who spoke up for creation and down for evolution, all the language that they use, I think that they give really their huge offence by the whole manner in which they prosecute their case. And we should not be there beneath reminding them of the wretched way in which they proceed, many of them. So we study the methods of the Apostle Paul here in a very high-pressure situation. But who knows where perhaps we may have opportunity to be in a situation to witness for the Lord and to be able to speak for him, that something of this, perhaps, we can remember. Courteousness there, to listen to what is being said, to respond to the main issues that are being raised. Indeed, not to be afraid to bring perhaps a little embarrassment to the cause of those who are against us because of their behaviour, because of their inconsistencies and the way in which they, at times, have had to change their minds rather embarrassingly. So, Paul's critics and ours, but we're still moving on to Rome, and we'll continue to follow the case, God willing, next week.